Parashas Tezriya Metzara deals, as the names are, tzaras, metzara. There are roughly many types of tzaras. There are, roughly speaking, three general categories of tzaras. There is personal tzaras, tzaras on a person's body, either white patches on the skin, different parts of the body, the face, or that also includes, for our purposes, tzaras in the hair, which is the hair falls out, and also discolorations, other types of discolorations. That's what we call tzaras haguf, a tzaras affliction that affects the body. Just to translate the word tzaras, we've discussed previously, English, it's commonly translated as leprosy. There is considerable debate among the commentaries whether tzaras is a biological disease, leprosy, or something else that actually is contagious and can be transmitted through the normal vectors of infection, air. We mentioned in previous lectures there are some who understand that the isolation of the metzara is a form of quarantine to prevent his disease from being contagious. Al-Safa Miata, one of the commentators, says the reason he's supposed to wrap his face is kind of a breath mask to keep his exhalations from infecting other people. Others learn it's more min hashamayim. We'll discuss that a little bit soon. It's more of a nace, a miracle. It's not an ordinary biological process. But whatever it is, this is the first category of tzaras haguf, tzaras that affects the one's person, the body, different parts of the body. That's in Parshas Tezriya. In Parshas Metzora, we have, also in Parshas Tezriya, we have the second category of Metzora, of tzaras at the end of the Parsha. That is tzaras habeged, tzaras of garments. Other types of textiles can become infected by tzaras. Also involves discolorations. There are different procedures how to deal with it. Eventually, you may have to burn it. But that's the second category of tzaras, tzaras habeged. Third category in Parshas Metzora is tzaras nigebatim, a tzaras that affects a house, a residence. It actually affects the wall of the house. The walls change colors. Again, there are elaborate procedures, a whole flowchart. First week, second week, take it out, replace it. Eventually, you may have to destroy the whole house. So broadly speaking, the procedures are similar. You first have kind of incubation periods. You lock it up for a week. You see what happens, if it gets worse, if it stays, if it spreads, if there are simanim. I'm not going to get into all the technical halachas of tzaras, but generally, there are three types of tzaras: tzaras of the person, tzaras of the garment, tzaras of the house. Now, as you mentioned earlier, tzaras of the body is understood by at least some commentators to be a biological disease, similar to other diseases that we know. There are statements in Chazal that it's actually a divine punishment for certain sins, for Lashon Hara, famous Gemara, other sins maybe, but be that as it may, there are also those who interpret it as a biological condition. The other types of tzaras of the house and the clothes are less clear, whether even less clear that these are biological at all. We do have problems that cause our walls to be discolored and clothes. We call it mold usually, or other types of problems, but hard to know. But the Rambam in particular, the Rambam's language suggests, it's not compelling, but the Rambam's language suggests that he understood that tzaras of the body is more of a natural biological process, while the other two are not. The Rambam has an entire section in the Yad HaChazaka of Tumas Tzaras. At the end of all the technical halachas, as he often does, he has a kind of musar, a kind of lessons to be learned, a kind of exhortation to moral conduct and the symbolism of tzaras. So he begins by saying, tzaras is a term that's used b'shutfus. In English, we might call it a homonym, a word that has different meanings or that includes several different meanings. And the Torah uses it to mean several different things. It's kolal in yanim harbe she'ein dom in zelazed. Includes several different categories which are dissimilar, the Rambam says. And he explains, what does that mean? He explains that the whiteness of the skin, the first category, tzaras of the person, is called tzaras. Also, he says, the beard, the hair falling out, he seems to call that a separate category. It's also a form of tzaras. Also, he says, the begadim, the change in color of the garment, or the batim, is also called tzaras. All these different things are called tzaras. He says, "V'zeh hashinoi ha'amar b'begadim u'v'matim." These changes, these discolorations that occur to clothes and homes—the last two categories—the Torah calls it tzaras b'shutfas Hashem, which are also called tzaras. Eino miminhaga shel olam. This is not the way of the world. This is not a naturalistic process. Ela osu pela haya b'Yisrael. This is a miracle. This is a sign from God to warn them about lashon hara, as Chazal say, and so on. So the Rambam's language strongly implies that this is not mold. This is not the normal stuff that happens when the pipe breaks in your house. This is a miracle from Hashem. This is something new. While the other two, he implies, the ones that afflict the person, the body or the hair, those he seems to imply are more naturalistic or are more similar to naturalistic processes. Be that as it may, these are the three or four categories of tsaras. Nigei, personal ones, which are two subcategories to the flesh, the skin, and the hair, and then the begadim, the garment, and then the batim. The Rambam goes on and talks about the lessons and the symbolism of tsaras. We're not going to read the whole thing now. Now, did tsaras actually happen? You know, we know today we don't practice the laws of tsaras. Nobody has ever experienced nobody's ever gone to the rabbi and gotten any halacha that tsaras is applicable. So we certainly don't, as a matter of fact, we do not practice the laws of tsaras today. There's an interesting question, why not exactly? Unlike many mitzvahs where the Torah explicitly says, or the rabbis tell us in the Talmud or elsewhere, rabbis tell us they don't apply b'zman hazeh, nowhere in the Talmud, in Tanakh, in the Talmud, does the Torah give any hint that tsaras should not apply today. It's not directly linked to the Beis HaMikdash. It's true that in the beginning of Parshas Metzora, we learn about the rituals for purifying the Metzora after it goes away. There are certain karbanos that are brought. So the purification process involves karbanos. We've discussed in previous occasions. Obviously, we don't bring karbanos b'zman hazeh, although some people keep trying. But there is actually a great halakhic debate about this. Why we don't have karbanos? Is it possible if the politics would allow it? Is it halakhically allowable to bring karbanos? A great debate about that. But certainly becoming a mitzvah in the first place does not involve any temple rituals. So why exactly don't we practice tsaras today? So there are basically two schools of thought. Some people just seem to assume we never get the conditions, that tsaras is a sign from Hashem. Certainly, as the Rambam says, tsaras of the garments or the home is a special nace, and even tsaras of the flesh, some commentators seem to assume, is a non-biological thing, it's a special sign from Hashem. We just don't have it. We never have that kind of skin discoloration that would be considered tsaras. So it's a moot point to ask whether the halacha is relevant or not. We just don't have the symptoms that would be called tsaras. Others seem to assume that we could potentially have skin diseases or skin discolorations that could be tsaras. They give other reasons for why we don't actually take it to a kohen and go through the whole procedure described in the Torah. Some say, as we mentioned earlier, because we can't do the purification, you'd be stuck with a lifetime tsaras. It's not fair or it's not logical. The Torah would expect you to become a mitzara without a way out. Some say that tsaras depends on a kohen. The entire procedure of tsaras, the diagnosis and the pronouncement of tameh, is all done by a kohen. It's not just because they were trained. The Talmud says it's a rule, just like only a kohen can do pidyon haben. Only a kohen can duchim, can do nesias kapayim. It's a halacha that only the kohen can pronounce a mitzara, tameh, and tahar. And if he doesn't know, he can consult a rabbi who knows the halacha, but you need the kohen to do the ritual step of declaring tameh and tahar. Even though we have kohanim today, some argue that we don't have such a high confidence in our kohanim. That's why we don't eat truma. Other things like that. So also we talked about that previously. How much confidence do we have in our kohanim? So there are various reasons given for why we don't actually practice tsaras. But the one type of tsaras whose applicability is already discussed in the Talmud is the fourth and final category of tsaras, and that is nigei batim. Afflictions of the house itself. That already comes up in the Talmud. The Talmud raises the question, does this actually occur, even in Talmudic times? When it comes to tsaras of people, we should note again, there are biblical references to actual mitzarayim. There's a famous haftarah we have, the Arba Mitzarayim. There were four mitzarayim who were isolated outside the camp, and they saw the great nace when Hashem drove away the horde, the armies of, in time of Chizkiah, I think it was. Not Chizkiah, one of the other kings of Tanakh. That could have been disease tsaras, it could have been biblical tsaras, but the Torah does talk about Mitzrayim. We have other references to Mitzrayim. We don't really have much in Tanakh or in rabbinic literature about actual cases of nigei batim or nigei begadim, afflictions of the house or the garments. So the Talmud already raises the question, does this kind of thing ever actually occur? Do you ever actually have a case of nigei batim? So the Talmud brings actually two opinions about it. The Talmud says, yes or no, right. The Talmud's yes and no. Well, it's apparently it's a dispute. The Talmud brings a brisa. The brisa says, Bayis HaManuga, a house that is afflicted by the tsaras, as described in Parshas Metzora, lo haya v'lo asid lias. Never happened, never will happen. So we'll discuss why in a moment, but the Talmud says, so if so, lama nichtav, why does the Torah talk about it? Talk about imaginary, fantastical things. So the Talmud says, drosh v'kabel schar, a famous rabbinic expression, study it and receive schar from God for studying his Torah and his word, but it's never actually going to happen. So why is it never going to happen, and what's the basis for such a claim? The Gemara says, because we're following here the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon, there is a Tanner, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon, who has the following. He has a very, very narrow view. He defines the conditions that you would have to meet to become a Bayis HaManuga, to become a house that has Taras. He defines the conditions so narrowly to make them virtually impossible. Specifically, he says, Ein HaBayis Tameh, to meet the conditions to become a Bayis that has Taras, it would have to meet the following conditions. At Shayira Kishtei Grisin, that's a share, two small spots. A gris is about the size of a penny or a dime. But the terrace would have to be at least two small spots. Al Shtei Avanim, they would have to be on two separate stones. Their houses were made of stone, like in Yerushalayim today, stones glued together with mortar. So we use bricks in here in the U.S. They had stones. It would have to be on two separate stones, at least one gris on each. B'shtei Ksalim, it would have to be where the walls join, one stone on this wall and one stone on that wall. So the nega would have to be in the corner, a gris on one, a penny size on one, and a penny size on the other. B'shtei Ksalim, B'keren Zavis, Arko Kishnei Grisim, would have to be two grisim long, and Rachva Kishnei Grisim. And where do we get all these conditions? So it says, because the word is, the Torah uses the word kir, kiros habayis. It says the nega appears, b'kiros habayis. The Torah says the nega appears, b'kiros habayis. There is a kri and ksiv. The word is either kir or kiros, so we say it has to be two kiros that appear like one kir, meaning it's a corner where the kiros join. So there are technical drushes how you arrive at this conclusion that they would have to be in the corner, and this is such a narrow and technically limiting set of circumstances. It could happen, I guess, but it's so implausible, it's so narrowly defined, that it's not likely that we'll ever have a nega that meets these conditions. So drush for Kabul Star.
Rabbi, so it sounds like situation.
Getting to that next, yes, okay. Exactly. So this Gemara, as Yael is pointing out, this Gemara, I jumped to the end of the Gemara. This Gemara appears in Sanhedrin in Perek Ben Sora Remora. This is one of three Gemaras. The Gemara goes through this type of Shachavataria, exactly as Yael was saying. It goes through this Shachavataria in three halachas. There are three halachas in the Torah where the Talmud makes this kind of argument. The first one is Ben Sora Remora, the second one is Eren Idachas, and the third one is Bayis HaManuga. Each one, the Gemara says, the Gemara brings a brisa that says lohaya v'lo asid lias ben sar amara lohaya v'lo asid lias lama nichtav drosh v'kabel schar. Discuss the reason for that in a moment. The Gemara says Eren Idachas is a halacha of Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is a capital crime in Judaism. If an individual worships idols, he's executed if all the conditions are met. Eren Idachas is a special category of Avodah Zarah where an entire city is worshiping Avodah Zarah. They're also killed, but there are special rules and special procedures followed and other halachas that are different. So it's a kind of super form of Avodah Zarah, but also Eren Idachas Lohaysa of Lohasid Elias. It's like Lohaya, the feminine form. It never happened, never will happen. Lamanichtava, Drosh Rikabal Skar. The third one is Bayis HaManuga, Bayis with Saras. Also, the Gemara says Lohaya of Lohasid Elias for the reason we just gave. So there's no question, Phil is mentioning the destruction that Hashem brought on the cities that were evil. There's no question that Hashem has occasionally, man has done it in wars, and God has done it through, Pompeii or Sodom and Gomorrah, other cities have been wiped out and have been exterminated. The Talmud is not saying there's some general rule that no city will ever be exterminated. It's saying it means the specific case of Eren Idachas, the specific implementation of this set of laws that the Beis Din wipes out a city, Beis Din executes an entire city, Beis Din commits a mass execution where the judicial process formally puts to death an entire city. That's not going to happen. There could be other disasters. There could be wars. Or like you said, there could be a divine weather events. There could be a Nisim that Hashem will do it. But this specific thing, you're right, it's an important point that it does happen, but it doesn't happen through the mechanism of Eren Idachas. Now, as you mentioned, there are always two opinions, yes or no. What's remarkable about this Gemara is that in each of these three cases, Ben Sora Remora, Eren Idachas, and Bayis HaManuga, in each of these three cases, the Gemara brings one opinion that says, Lo Hayav Lo Asid Lias, and another opinion that says, it happened and I was there. With regard to not literally I was there, but the first one, Ben Sora Remora, the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yonasan, yeah, I was there. Anira Yisuf, I saw it. Via Shafti al Kivro, I sat at the grave. We don't usually sit on graves, but I sat at the grave. I was there. Don't tell me it never happened. The second one, Eren Idachas, Also, never happened, the first opinion says. I'm Rabbi Yonason, again Rabbi Yonason, he got around, it looks like. I'm Rabbi Yonason, I don't know if he was a halachic tourist, he investigated all these things, but it says, I'm Rabbi Yonason, Ani Harisi of Eshavti El Tila. I saw an Erani Dachas, I sat on the ruins, on the raised, the foundations of the Erani Dachas. The third one, Bayis HaManuga. The Gemara also brings Lohayav Lohasid Elias. The Gemara says, here we have a different Tana. Here the Gemara says, I'm Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Tzadok, Makam Haya B'tchum Azza. There was a certain place in the region of Azza. Hayukarinosa, Churvasa Segirta. They called it in Aramaic a Churvas Mitzara. The empty, the ruin, the house has to be knocked down eventually. The house of a Mitzara. Segirta means locked up. It's a word from Mitzara. There was a place they called the remains of a Tzaras house. And another opinion, Rabbi Shimon Ish Kvaraku, Pamachas Alachti LeGalil. Once I traveled to the Galil, the region of Eretz Israel called the Galil. Reisi Makum Shemitzainino, so I saw a place that was carefully marked off. Amru, what's special about this place? There were biohazard signs, whatever there were signs that say, special, keep out, whatever they said. And then that's what do these signs mean? They said, Avanim and Ugoz, Pinu Lasham. They took away the stones of Abayas. It says, Upinu Esa Avanim, you clear away the stones. This is the place they dumped the stones and they marked them for posterity. Everyone should know, here are the stones for Abayas HaManuga. So on the one hand, we have claims that Lohayav, all three of these things, Lohayav, Lohasid Lios, never happened, never will happen for various technical reasons. Other people said, no, they did happen. I was there. I saw it. This is very interesting. And there is a school of thought in Talmudic learning that says, Tanaim, rabbis in the Talmud are only supposed to argue about the law, not about the facts. But apparently sometimes they argue about the facts too. Here we have arguments. I don't know any way to explain this without an argument about the facts. One of them said it never happened. Says, yes, it did. I was there. It did happen. So we do have two opinions. That's the first thing we have to note about this Gemara. Now getting down to the Gemara, getting into the Gemara in a little more detail. So as we mentioned, in each case, the one who said, Lohayav Lohasid Lios, he made an intricate Talmudic argument for why he thought it would never happen. We mentioned he didn't have proof that it never happened, but he argued, based on the laws of the particular halacha, he argued that there are reasons to believe that it would never happen in the real world. Bayis HaManuga we discussed, because the nega has to be in such a particular and specific set of circumstances, it was so improbable it would never happen. Ben Sarah Gemara is the first example. Why would that never happen? So the Gemara says, the Gemara brings the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda, that's how the sugya actually starts. The Mishnah brings Rabbi Yehuda's opinion that if there's some problem with the marriage, the Gemara says, what does that mean? So the Gemara says, they have to match, they have to be a matched couple. What does that mean? The Gemara goes further. The father and mother have to be the same height, they have to look the same, whatever that means exactly, and they have to have the same voice, they have to be identical in physical characteristics. Why, we don't know. This is apparently a Xeris Akasim, perhaps, but they have to meet these peculiar, extraordinarily narrow, specific conditions. If the mother and father don't match, they don't become Ben Sarah Mara. Why? Again, it's a drasha, Xeris Akasim. Einenu Shamea Bikolenu. Our voice implies we have the same voice. Again, Kolenu figuratively means our instructions, but here the Talmud understands it to mean literally our voice, the pitch, the timbre, the whatever it is. Midikol bein and shavin, they have to have the same voice. Mar v'kam and nami bein and shavin, they have to have the same look and the same height. So basically, unless you have a father and mother who match in all these circumstances, can't be a ben sarah mara. This is so implausible, so improbable, that it is never going to happen. Lohaya v'lo asid lios. Drosh v'kabal tzchar. The Gemara brings actually another opinion why it would be lohaya v'lo asid lios. Rabbi Shimon's opinion. Rabbi Shimon says, what did this kid do already? He ate a little bit of meat. He drank some wine. Parents aren't going to kill him. What parents would do that? Other than Imam Matinos and Losaklo, what parents have such a callous or cold attitude toward their kid that they would do this? So it's psychologically, sociologically, it's never going to happen. Lohaya, no parents would be so unnatural. Lohaya v'lo asid lios, never going to happen. You need the parents' cooperation to participation to become a ben sarah mara. Lama nichtav, drosh v'kabal schar. It's just there for darshaning. And then Rabbi Yonason says, I was there, Yashafkel Kivro. I did find parents who... So what happened? What happened to these arguments that parents can't be shoven b'kol mara uberech? So presumably the pshat is, that's Rabbi Yehuda Shita. He doesn't agree with Rabbi Yehuda. He says there is no such requirement that you have to have shoven b'kol mara uberech. We shouldn't mention also, right away, who do we paskin like in this? Again, we're not going to find in the Shulchan Aruch, we don't have laws of Ben Sora Mora as a living halacha, but who does the halacha follow in this dispute? So, again, we don't paskin history per se, but this is a halacha question. Does Ben Sora Mora require this condition of Shoven, Mikol, Mara, and Koma? And the answer seems to be that we do not paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. We paskin like Rabbi Yonasan. The Rambam in the Yad HaChazaka does not bring anything about Shoven, Mikol, Mara, Vekoma. These are remarkably wildly implausible conditions of matching height, matching voice, and matching appearance. In the Pirush Mishnayos, the Rambam explicitly says, Ein halachik Rabbi Yehuda. Other Mefarshim, the Rabbeinu Avadia Bar Tanura, even Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen, I just saw in one of his works, says, Itchem halacha, we don't paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. So if anything, the normative halacha, to the extent that there is one, does not follow Rabbi Yehuda. People commonly know the expression Ben Zora Mor Lohay of Losid Lios, but the halacha seems to be that we do not follow that opinion. Rather, we follow the opinion that it does happen, it could happen, and maybe actually did happen even in history. Irani Dachas, Bayis Hamanuga, we already discussed why it doesn't happen, because the nega has to appear on the corner exactly in the right spot. Irani Dachas, why does that never happen? So the Gemara says, because it follows the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer says, what do you do in Erni Dachas? You burn all the stuff. You kill the people, and you burn all the material in Erni Dachas. So it says, you can't burn a Sefer Torah. We know that you never burn Sefer Torah. So, or even a mezuzah, a Sefer, anything. As long as the house has a single mezuzah somewhere in the city, you can't fulfill the commandment to burn kol shalala, to burn all the spoils of the city. Mezuzah you can't burn. So if there's even one Sefer, one mezuzah, one item that you can't burn in the whole city, then it's the whole parasha is not implemented, and you simply reduce this to regular case of Avodah Zarah. We don't apply Irani Dachas. So what Jewish city, a city full of Jews, is not going to have a single mezuzah? Again, it's possible, theoretically, it's physically possible, but it's so wildly implausible. L'hoya v'lo'asid lios, never going to actually happen. Again, the other shita says it did happen. Maybe he holds that it's not ma'akiv. You can't do kol shlala, so you do what you can. You burn whatever you can. So this is the Gemara, three cases where one opinion says Lahoya Vlos and Leos and Drosh Vakabal Schar, and the other opinion says, no, it happened and I was there. Now, a number of years ago, eight years ago or so, I got into an argument with Professor Chaim Soloveitchik about this Gemara. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik is one of the leading historians of medieval Judaism. He wrote an essay on Kiddush Hashem, discussing the idea during it's appropriate for Yom HaShoah, I guess. He wrote an essay discussing Kiddush Hashem during the Crusades. Specifically, he was discussing martyrdom, the willing desire of people to give up their lives to avoid baptism, to avoid becoming Christians, and in particular to even kill children. There are numerous stories. We'll read about them on Tisha B'Av and some of the Kinos. Numerous stories of parents or teachers who kill children rather than have them fall into the hands of the Christians and be raised as Christians, as non-Jews. And there's considerable halachic dispute about whether that was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. The German tradition typically revered these people as kedoshim and martyrs, and the Balei Tosfos and their schools, they typically came up with reasons to justify what they had done, that it was the right course of action. Professor Soloveitchik, in an essay, argues that their halachic arguments are weak and implausible, and he says it was clearly a question of ex post facto justification to justify what these people had done, who were revered in the German Jewish traditions as martyrs. But looking at the arguments objectively, the arguments don't really hold water. And he wrote an entire essay trying to argue that their arguments are weak. I'm not going to get into all his points, but there was one point he made which I disagreed with very strongly. One of the arguments made by some of the German poskim, the Smack, I think it was, one of the arguments made was to justify killing children to avoid having them fall into the hands of the Christians was an inference from Ben Sora Remora. There is a famous expression about Ben Sora Remora that it says, why do we kill a Ben Sora Remora? What has he done? He hasn't done anything which is a capital crime. He stole, he was a glutton, he disobeyed his parents. You know, these are sins, but they're relatively minor sins. Why do we execute a Ben Sora Remora? Yes, right. So as Yale notes, it's a famous Talmudic expression, Ben Sora Remora Nehrag al Shem Sofo. He's on a bad path. He's going to end up as a murderer and as a capital criminal in other areas. Better put an end to his dark path now than to let it unfold and he'll actually be guilty of heinous crimes. So Yomus Zakai Val Yomus Chayev, better that we execute him now than that he should be allowed to live and actually bepoel and actually do all the things that we anticipate him doing. This is something which is, to a large extent, alien to Jewish thought. Usually we say, the famous Medrash about Yishmael, it says that when Yishmael was dying of thirst in Bereshis, Hagar called out to Hashem, she cried, and Hashem wanted to have Rachmanas on Yishmael. And other Malachim said, Yishmael's descendants will do terrible things to the Jews. You know, we know about this, that they cause terrible problems later. They're going to torture the Jews in the time of the Churban or later times. So why should we save his life? And Hashem said, the Pasuk says that Hashem told Hagar, I heard as kol hanar ba'asher husham, I heard the voice of the child where he is now. So this is a very famous drush of Chazal, ba'asher husham, God's justice does not look into the future. God knows the future, but God's justice, God's hanhaga, looks into what the person is now. Right now, he's a child, an innocent child who's dying miserably of thirst and sickness in the desert. He deserves compassion. Avram deserves compassion for him, whatever it is. And I'm going to save his life. So Basher Husham is the normal rule that we apply in Judaism. For some reason, Ben Sarah Umara, there's a different rule that we apply. Nerag al Shem Sofo, Hashem says, execute him now because he's going to end up in a bad place. So this opinion, to justify the martyrdom in the Crusades, this opinion says that Yomus Zakhev al Yomus Chayev, we have these poor innocent children now, that right now they're still holy and pure. If they are raised by the Christians, they're going to end up as being Christians, which is a terrible thing. Yomus Zakhev al Yomus Chayev. It is better that we end their lives now than that they be raised as Christians. So says Professor Soloveitchik, he says, this is a bizarre argument, he says. He says, first of all, he says, the Gemara itself says, Ben Sarah Mara lo hayav lo asid liyas. Never happened, never will happen. We don't paskin. Ben Sarah Mara was rendered, he says, inoperative. It was rendered a dead letter by the sages. They themselves rejected it. Soloveitchik says, they didn't like Ben Sarah Mara. They felt it was against, the rabbis felt it was against the spirit of Judaism, so they wrote it out of the halacha. So the early sages of the Talmud already decided that Ben Sarah Mara is not something we can practice. It's morally unacceptable, and therefore you certainly cannot hold up Ben Sarah Mara as a precedent for anything else. The problem with Soloveitchik's argument is that this is a modern reading of the Gemara, popular among progressive elements in Orthodoxy. It is not the traditional plan of the Gemara. Soloveitchik, and he's actually quoting earlier progressive Orthodox theologians, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, Rabbi Moshe Halbertal, a contemporary thinker, they all propose reading the Gemara like this, that the rabbis, the reason they say Lohayev Losid Lios, it stemmed from their moral conscience. It bothered them. We're going to execute a 12-year-old. That's how old he is. We're going to execute a 12-year-old because we think he's going to end up in a bad place. What happened to redemption? What happened to innocence? What happened to youth? They just could not stomach the idea morally of executing 12-year-olds, innocent 12-year-olds. So they came up with excuses to render the Torah's halacha a dead letter. This is the kind of argument you hear sometimes today, that we have to rewrite the Torah in accordance with our modern moral sensibilities. The problem is, that's not what the Gemara actually says. The Gemara has no hint of any suggestion that this bothered the conscience of the rabbis. The Gemara says, you know why it was Lahayev Lo Asid Lios? Because there are technical conditions that have to be met. It has to be Shaveh, Bekol, Bemaro, Bekoma. There's no hint in this Gemara of anything to do with a moral objection to the Halach of the Torah. This is a very modern idea, which certainly is not the sort of thing the Gemara would have been contemplating. The Professor Halbertal, in his book, he has a book called Interpretive Revolutions, Ma'apechot, Parshaniot, or something, where he has this, also the thesis that Chazal, who couldn't stomach morally certain things in the Torah, they found technical reasons to write them out and change them. He brings this Gemara. He brings the second part of the Gemara. The Gemara says, according to Rabbi Shimon, what parent would do this? What parent would do this? It's never going to happen. So the simple reading of the Gemara, which even he concedes, is, it's again, as I said earlier, it's a sociological or psychological statement that no parent would do this, so realistically it's not going to happen. He proposes reading the Gemara that it's a, no parent should do this, that it's wrong, it's morally wrong, it can't be the Torah would ask this of us, and therefore we can't actually put this into practice. But again, that's not the traditional way of reading a Gemara, that's not the traditional way of looking at the Torah. This is a theologically very provocative idea that we can look at the Torah and decide that we don't like the moral teaching of the Torah and find some excuse to reinterpret it. This is certainly not the way the Rishonim in the time of the Crusades would have interpreted it. This is certainly not the way most traditional authorities would have interpreted it. And moreover, as I pointed out, some poskim explicitly say that we don't paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. That the even though we have heard of this principle that ben tzarim aro lo hayo v'lo asid lios, that's not the normative opinion. The Rambam doesn't paskin like that. There's no shulchan aruch. Again, the ikar lahalach is I was there. He did see it. He says that we do have ben tzarim aro. Moreover, Rabbi Berkovitz and Professor Soloveitchik and Halbertal, they all focus on Ben Sarah Mara. But as I explained, there are three Gemaras here. Ben Sarah Mara, fine. You can argue that it's morally a troubling halacha. Irini Dachas, mass execution, fine. Maybe that's troubling. Bias Hamanuga, there's nothing morally provocative about Bias Hamanuga. Of all the halachas Chazal could have picked that might trouble people, the idea of tearing down a house, it's expensive if you don't have good homeowners insurance. If you do it yourself, the homeowners insurance may not honor it. If you say for ritual reasons I have to tear down my house, you might have trouble getting a claim that way. But that's not a halacha which presumably of all the halachas in the Torah Chazal could have picked to morally object to, doesn't sound like that's high on the list. So the Parshat Pshat of the Gemara is not like these modern theologians argue and historians argue. The Parshat Pshat of the Gemara is Chazal had purely technical reasons for arguing lo hayav lo asid lios, and indeed there's a conflicting opinion that says no, it could happen. I disagree with your technical objections. It could happen. It did happen, and I was there. Yes.
Okay. What I understand, you're citing a case where parents killed their children during the crusades.
Yes.
In order to prevent them from being Christians.
From being seized by Christians, raised in monasteries, and
this is not a case of Ben Sora.
No.
It's not even the same case.
No, not at all the same case.
Okay. So, I don't know how that gets into this.
That's a valid point. Phil is making another point, that putting aside Soloveitchik's philosophical objections, you can argue that this is not a closely argued, rigorous... As we said, Ben Tzarim Aro is the exception rather than the rule. Usually we say, Basher Husham, to make a rigorous halachic argument, to leap from Ben Tzarim Aro to killing children in the Crusades, is a huge jump, and I'm not arguing with that. Soloveitchik overall is making some good points that these are not the closely reasoned halakhic arguments that we would typically expect on a serious halakhic issue, and that's a valid point. I was just focusing on this specific argument, which I think is a modern revisionist argument, which doesn't hold water.
Another point is that when these parents killed their children because of a fear of something, it seems to me that's murder. They committed murder on their children.
Yeah, so the question of whether this was murder or whether this is martyrdom is actually discussed. If you look in the one of the places where this terrible story is recounted is in the Das Kenami Balei Tosfos, one of the commentaries of the Balei Tosfos on the Pentateuch, on the Chumash. It actually appears in Parshas Noach, where it talks about the Shofich Dam Ha'adam, Ba'adam Dam Yishofich, and so on, and the punishment for murder, and suicide is a sin. So right over there, the Balei Tosfos bring a debate. They said there was once a certain rabbi, a teacher of children, who when he saw that the Christians were overwhelming them, he killed the children in his care. Another rabbi felt like Phil was furious and said, "You're a murderer." And the first rabbi said, "No, I did what I had to do." And the second rabbi says, "No, absolutely not. What you did was murder, and you're going to meet a bad end. You'll see." And sure enough, the first rabbi who had done this terrible thing eventually was captured by the Christians and was tortured to death and died a horrible death. So there are two opinions. There's no question. Not everyone agreed that this is the right thing to do. Some felt, you know, again, we do have to distinguish between martyrdom of one's own person and martyrdom of something else. We actually have, if you read the keynotes carefully this year, you will see, though, there are actual accounts of parents killing children. There's one particularly heartbreaking story where it says parents took their children and they said, "You know, we did not merit to bring you up as good Jews. The only thing we can do is destroy you, so you shouldn't fall into the hands of the Christians." We know there were parents and teachers who did this. Whether they were right or wrong is something, again, nobody's going to judge, obviously. Yeah, that's what the other rabbi said. He said, "Yiplu, let Hashem do what he needs to do. Let them kill themselves. You shouldn't." There were two opinions. And it's a big so again, and we're not going to get into the arguments for, not going to get too deeply into the arguments. And of course, I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to sit here and pass judgment on people in such an unthinkable, such a horrific... Even Soloveitchik makes this point. Soloveitchik is not criticizing. He's just saying that the only way to understand what they did, he says, you have to understand what it meant to be a Jew, how deeply they felt their Jewishness, and how for them, Ishmad and being raised as a Christian was just the end of the world for them. It was a fate literally worse than death in their minds. That was their mindset. Whether it was halakhically correct or not, we can debate, but although certainly we're not going to judge them, certainly we can understand the depth of their religious commitments. That's what happened. Anyway, this is Lohaya of Loasid Lios. The other opinion says Lohaya of Loasid Lios, and it was written Drosh v'Kabel Skar. Now, obviously, the next thing we have to understand is, what is Drosh V'Kabel Skar? What does that mean? Why are we getting Skari? What does Drosh mean? So, one approach taken by some of the commentators is Drosh V'Kabel Skar means that there is a moral lesson, even if the technical implementation of the parsha is not going to ever happen in practice, there is a moral lesson to be learned from the parsha. There is some hashgafic truth, or some theological truth, or some mussar we should learn from the parsha that we should learn. What do we learn from Ben Sora Mora? So I saw a few suggestions. The Sefer Chassidim, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, says what you learn from the parsha is a parenting lesson, that it's a really bad idea to spoil your child. He says that he brings the pasuk. It says about David's son Avshalom. It says Avshalom was one of David's various sons who had rebelled against him. And the Torah explicitly says what happened to him. Why did he rebel? What went wrong? The Torah says Lo atzavo aviv me'olam lomar madu asisa kacha. His father never reprimanded him and chided him and says, "Why are you doing this? Stop this." Basically, he spoiled him. Famous biblical aphorism: "Spare the rod, spoil the child." Children need, today we would say children need boundaries. Back then they said children need punishment. But whatever it is, an important aspect of parenting is that children need discipline, they need rules, they need teaching about right and wrong. And if not, it leads to terrible things. The Ben Sora Mara is that if you let your kid get away with stuff like this, eventually he's going to slide downhill and degenerate and end up being a terrible person. That doesn't mean you have to kill the child for stealing the goodies, but the point is, the lesson is the terrible potential of an undisciplined child, the potential of terrible things that can develop from not disciplining a child. Another explanation I saw says that the lesson is how devoted someone should be to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We should even be willing to execute it, like Akedah, should be willing to execute a child if necessary for the command of Hashem and to further the service of Hashem. Again, it's realistically a very hard thing to expect from a parent. Avraham Avinu did it, but some of the people in the Crusades did it, but in general, hopefully we'll never be called upon to do it, and we're not supposed to do it in general, but in general, the lesson is how devoted someone should be to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that like Akedah, that nothing should be off limits in the service of Hashem. In general, I just want to spend a few minutes on a broader question, which is, there's a great tension throughout Torah between the extent to which Torah is about the practical, learn the Gemara to know what the halacha is, learn the halacha to know what to do. At the end of the day, Mishnah Berurah, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, whatever your Aruch HaShulchan, whatever your Kaf HaChaim, whatever your sefer of choice is, ultimately, Torah is about mitzvahs. Torah is about doing the will of Hashem. You have to know what to do. Lo amar it's chassid. You can't be a chassid without knowing what Hashem wants from you. So Torah is about knowing what Hashem wants you to do. There is another dimension. Torah itself is important to study. Rav Chaim Volozhin, Torah Lishma, the idea that you connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through studying his Torah, that studying Torah itself is an end in and of itself. That's the way you access God. That's the way you serve God. That's the way you connect to God. Is by the way you understand God is by studying His wisdom, independent of any practical applications. And this has been a tension, really, in Talmudic times. The Talmud has a debate about which is greater, midrash or maaseh, study or actions. The Gemara has a famously paradoxical conclusion. The Gemara says, Talmud gadol shemevi lidei maaseh. Study is the most important because it leads to Maisa. So which is it? If study is only a means to the end, it sounds like the Maisa is more important, but the study is more important. This is a great tension that has kind of gone back and forth throughout the ages. So we do know, I like to point out, we do know that there has been much greater weight in the development of Torah literature on topics that are relevant to Maisa. The Talmud itself, Talmud Bavli, we only have Talmud Bavli on pretty much four of the six Sidrei Mishnah. We only have on Moed, Nashim, Zikim, and we don't have Zroim, we don't have Kudshim. Really, we don't really have Kudshim. We have a little bit of Kudshim. Kudshim we do have. I'm sorry, we have Kudshim, but we don't have Zroim. We don't have Taras. Zroim is mostly about mitzvahs Tluyas Baretz, which today are very relevant in Israel, but in the time of Talmud Bavli and Bavel was not relevant. So they didn't really write. We don't have Talmud on Zroim, and Taras has to do with ritual purity and impurity. We don't have either, presumably because they didn't really practice these things outside the temple, outside the sacrificial. We weren't dealing with Truma and Kudshim. They didn't really practice Taras. We do have Kudshim, but a lot of Kudshim is very practical. So, for example, Chulin is all about the laws of Kashrus and Shchita and Gid Anasha and Basar B'Cholav and Taruvas and Treif. Much of what we have in Kudshim is practical. But it is clear the Talmud focus, Talmud Bavli, the Yerushalmi, we do have on Zerah because they lived in Israel. We do have, it seems, Talmud Bavli focused on the halachas that were practical. It's certainly in the Rishonim, the Rambam wrote on everything. But the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva, they did not write also. They did not write where there was no Talmud Bavli. They did not even write on Kodshim, on Zvachim, Menachas. We don't have most of the standard Rishonim. And overall, most of the literature we have, certainly the whole literature of Shelos and Shuvos, which are obviously written for practical, mostly for practical questions, by and large, most of the development of Torah literature throughout the centuries has been on areas of halacha which were more relevant. In the medieval period, Chosh and Mishpat, Eben Ezer, civil law was very relevant because they practiced it, they had their own Batei Din. Today we're having a renaissance in Beis Din. For a while in America it wasn't that common, but in Europe they were still practicing civil law. Sephardim, Ashkenazim, all practiced Jewish civil law. Chosh and Mishpat was important, Eben Ezer was important, Yoredeya, Arachayim, but we have relatively much less literature on the topics. You have some, you always have some, but relatively speaking, there was a lot less discussion of things that weren't so nageya l'maisa. There's a famous passage in the Chovos HaLevavos. The Chovos HaLevavos was one of the great early svarim of Musar, of ethical conduct in the early medieval period, 11th century. So he writes in the introduction, he talks about how people spend a lot of time on the technical aspects of Judaism, the matzah, and the kashering, making your kitchen kosher for Pesach, and bugs, which are all important, he says, but those are what he calls the Chovos HaEvarim, the physical actions, the physical mitzvahs. People, he says, unfortunately, in his judgment, spend much less time on the Chovos HaLevavos, on the duties of the heart, which are midos and feelings and spirituality. He thinks people should spend comparatively more time on Chovos HaLevavos and less time, and that's wrong to de-emphasize Chovos HaLevavos in favor of Chovos HaEvarim. He says the early Torah scholars, he says, they, when they study Torah, they would study the basic principles. They wouldn't spend time on all the minutiae, on every detail, on every type of possibility. They would study the basics, and then they would go back to learning Musar. When they had a practical question, they would look it up, or they would investigate, they would get an answer. They would go back. They wouldn't spend all their time on speculating about abstract and arcane questions and corner cases. And it was important to focus on the Chovos HaLevavos, on Musar. He actually criticizes the Derech HaLimud in his time. He says people are too involved in technical things and on things that are not nagei. He takes this position to an extreme that we shouldn't spend time studying, we shouldn't focus too much of our time studying halacha, studying Torah that is not practical. Hashem wants us to focus on the basic rules and the practical questions as they arise, and the rest we should study, develop our character, study Musar, and grow spiritually. This is not the mainstream approach. Obviously, I haven't seen that many people directly reject him, but clearly the tradition has been that we do spend much more time studying Torah, including the more abstract cases. Partly life has gotten so complicated, you can't just study the basics and then investigate case by case as things come up. There's so much Torah to learn, you have to keep learning to keep up with the basics. But beyond that, this is, as I said, the tension that we have for thousands of years in Judaism. To what extent do we say the Ikar is the Maisa, just focus on the Maisa, what you need to know for the Maisa, let everything else fall by the wayside? To what extent do we say Gadol Talmud, that the Torah Lishma means learning Torah itself, regardless of practicality? Here the Gemara says, Drosh V'Kabel Schar. One way to understand it is, we said earlier, is just we learn certain Musar lessons. Another way to understand it is, it's just Torah. It's the Torah itself. Torah is self-justifying. We don't need to look for any practical benefit. What do I get out of it? Torah itself is an end in and of itself. Studying the Torah itself exposes you to the wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, allows you to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. At the end of the day, we don't actually know. It's not entirely clear what the Gemara means when it says Drosh V'Kabel Schar. We have several other Gemaras that also touch on or grapple with this question of, is it appropriate to study Torah, to emphasize aspects of Torah that are not practical? There's a Gemara in Baba Basra. The Gemara talks about a certain halacha. If you find a small bird, if it's within 50 amas, 50 cubits of a nest, of a birdhouse, you assume it came from that house. If it's farther away, you say it could have come from somewhere else. So the cutoff line is 50 amas, 75 to 100 feet. So the Gemara says it's a small bird, it kind of hops along, it doesn't really fly, so it wouldn't really go much further than 50 amas. If it's further than 50 amas, then it's too far for it to have come from the birdhouse. So Rav Yirmiyah, one of the rabbis of the Talmud, says, well, what if one leg is within 50 and the other leg is outside 50? That was his question. So they threw him out. They expelled him from the Beis Medrash. They said, get out of here, they said. Afku Amibay Medrasha. Why? Where did that reaction come from? So Rashi says, you know why they did that? Rashi says, because he's being a nudnik, because he was asking wildly implausible. Rashi says that Aldaf kuah hematriach aleihem. He was bothering them with ridiculous questions. One leg here, one leg there. You'll worry about that when it happens. That's not what you have to spend your time worrying about. Tosa says, no, that's not true. Tosa says this mission itself, in the same sugya, we find other opinions that get into these very, very narrow corner cases. The Gemara talks about, Mishnah talks about mechtel mechza. It talks about karav lezeh, karav, there are two birdhouses, if it's closer to this one, closer to that one. What if it's exactly halfway in between? Also, exactly halfway in between, when is that going to happen? Mishnah feels it's important to tell us that rule. So it is important to tell us, the Mishnah does feel it's important to tell us, is important to tell us these corner cases. So here you have a kind of machlokas, Rashi and Tosis, whether these types of corner cases are important to discuss and raise and consider or not important, and you should worry about them when it happens. Elsewhere, the Gemara uses the expression Hilchos El Mashiach. We don't normally paskin halacha, things that are not relevant until Mashiach comes, a temple service. That could just be an objection to the Lashon Hilchos El. We don't use the language of halacha. We can study it, but we shouldn't. Paskining implies it's relevant. In general, this is a difficult and knotty question. To what extent are we interested in? Should we focus on things that are not practical? To what extent should we limit our study to the more practical?